How we doing, tribe? Amadon DeLerba here with Get Real or Die Trying podcast episode 38. Today we are sitting down with Shelly Tegelsky. Super stoked to have her. She is really a cool person. In my research about her, I just get more and more impressed with all that she is doing. She is an author of Sit Down to Rise Up. She's a mindfulness teacher. She's a community organizer, a philanthropist, a self-care activist, public speaker, former corporate executive. She left all that. She's a mother, a wife, a sister, a daughter, a friend, of course. And she's a helper, and she's a servant. And as she'll self-describe herself, she's a good Samaritan. And so let's sit down and have a great conversation with Shelly.
Nothing you do matters unless what you do matters. I'm Amadon DeLerba, and this is Get Real or Die Trying.
How we doing, tribe? We are here with Shelly Tegelsky. This is Get Real or Die Trying podcast, episode 38. How are you doing today, Shelly?
I'm doing well. I am in some ways treading water, but in some ways swimming marathons.
Absolutely. I can totally relate to that mindset and that position in life. Whenever you take on tackling a lot of good, that's what we deal with. So I appreciate you making the time to come on to my show and talk to me, and looking forward to getting to know you more and having my viewers and audience get to know you more too.
Great. I'm really looking forward to it as well.
So yeah, they just heard a little bit about you in the bio and all that you do. Do you want to, in your own words, maybe give us a quick little download on what you've been up to recently and where you're at right now in your life?
Yeah. So let me start, I guess, with the geographic stuff, because that I think is probably the easiest to detail. My husband and I are actually living a nomadic life right now. We sold our house in July of 2020. Our son, who is our only son, graduated from high school in May of 2020. So you can imagine no graduation, no end of the year, you know, hurrah. First year, freshman year of college was online. And we sold the house because we had been talking about doing that for a really long time, even pre-pandemic. And we really looked at each other after the house sold and thought, like, where do we go now? And the truth is that we had no idea where we wanted to move. So we thought, wouldn't it be an adventure if we just spend 4 to 5 months living in different places that we've always visited, or thought, hey, this would be a cool place to live. But, you know, every place seems like a cool place to live for like a week when you're there.
Yeah.
And it's been really great. So far, we've been in places like Asheville, North Carolina. We've been to Santa Barbara. We've been to Lake Tahoe. I'm currently in Miami. And this summer, we're spending a lot of time in the Caribbean island of Grenada. So that's going to be really interesting for 4 months. So that's geographically, I've sort of been all over the place. I most recently just came back from Uvalde, Texas, where the mass shooting happened at Robb Elementary School, and my organization, Pandemic of Love, has been working with the aftermath of mass shootings in this country since the Parkland shooting happened in 2018. And we've been working with an organization called Survivors Empowered, which was founded by parents whose daughter was murdered at the Aurora movie theater shooting. And in 2012, they sold all their belongings, bought a motor coach, and basically have become really first responders when these types of occurrences happen here in the U.S. And so we've joined forces with them. And really, our goal is to help provide mental health support long-term, long after the cameras and the 15-minute hoopla and the circus is over, when families really still are left holding the pieces of their grief. Because we know all too well, you know, what kind of a road that is. And it's a very long road, and one that really never ends to some degree, right? And I am heading out actually to Poland now. I'm going back out to Poland and Ukraine, where I was also in March, to continue our really incredible work with Global Empowerment Mission, an organization that has thus far raised more than $150 million for Ukraine. Ukrainian relief. And that relief has come in many different forms.
Wow. Very cool. Well, you sound like literally a mover and a shaker. That's really great. So are you van lifing it, or what's your travel mode? Are you hitting hotels, or how do you hit the circuit there?
Well, we've been actually in like Airbnbs. So Airbnbs, right? We try to transact off of Airbnb as much as possible. Although I love Airbnb for shorter term rentals, but it doesn't always seem feasible when you're trying to rent for 4 to 5 months. You wind up paying an exorbitant amount of fees. So we've been in other people's homes with other people's furniture. The best part about this lifestyle, and I guess the most surprising part for me, was that 2 years ago when we sold the house, we also got rid of like 80% of our belongings. And, it kind of makes you really reevaluate your life about like, what is it that I really need? And, you know, why did I even have this thing that's been sitting in a closet or in my garage for like 10 years that I didn't even know existed, right? And now being on the road, you know, and living out of suitcases, it's been interesting to also, you know, kind of have that litmus test of like, do I really need this? Do I really need to purchase it? Do I really need to carry it with me from place to place? And it's actually been a remarkable sort of epiphany for me to realize that there really isn't that much that we need, and that you know, that less is really more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people are actually discovering that same thing on their own journeys. And, you know, the last few years with the pandemic, there's been a kind of a movement to get on the road, to travel, to simplify, to enjoy nature, really. That's what I really thought was very cool. One aspect, positive aspect about the pandemic is it drove a lot of people into nature, because they're not going into the movie theaters or the bars or the clubs and all the things that shut down the first year and being in crowds. And so the form of diversion and recreation for people and families was going outside and enjoying it. RV rentals skyrocketed, campgrounds skyrocketed, the national parks, the ones that were open, you know, it was, and that's actually a great thing that people can reconnect with that side of themselves. And I have spoken to many people similar to yourself who sold their home, sold their business, and it just really was a point in their life, a defining point where they really reevaluated, what am I doing? You know, what is all this stuff? Yeah. What's important in life? You know, wow. And kind of had an epiphany. And I think for you, I was reading your story, and you grew up an Orthodox Jew. You were in corporate America, and you had some type of epiphany. And I'm just curious. I'm all about transformations and spiritual journeys and reinventing yourself. And so maybe you can tell our audience a little bit about kind of your start on your journey to living a life of what I feel is a life of service, because you're living a life of service right now, which is really beautiful. Not everybody chooses to do that. Not everybody is trying to help other people. In fact, in Western culture, the desire is about self. And, not the good self-care that we're going to talk about in a little bit, too, which you're very involved in. But it's selfishness and greed and get more and do the job and do that. Or at the very most, provide for, you know, my nuclear family. But you're really trying to help people all over the world, which I think is beautiful. And something happened in your spirit and soul, I believe, that led you to have that moment in time and space where you had that epiphany, and maybe you can enlighten us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it is really interesting to kind of reflect back and think about the fact that, you know, I'm one generation removed from an illiterate woman on a mountaintop in Baghdad, Iraq, who was a refugee. And, you know, my mother herself was 2 years old when she left, Iraq in the middle of the night with one suitcase per family. She was one of 17 children. I grew up as an Orthodox Jew. And I will say, for those people who understand that there's sort of like different Jews from different places in the diaspora. So like there's Ashkenazi Jews who are like Eastern European Jews, tend to be more educated, quote unquote. This is like, you know, this was a stereotype, right? But like, also the truth is that they were taught to read. They went to schools. They were in places that were, let's say, much more Westernized. and Sephardic Jews, which is, you know, people like from Iraq or Syria or Egypt or other places in the North Africa or Middle East region, which is where my family's all from. And, you know, especially the women were not really educated or taught to read, would not, you know, complete school, maybe primary school, be married off like really early. I have some aunts, believe it or not, who were married off as early as the age of 12 when wow. they were still in Iraq. Yeah. So, I mean, wow. they're in their 90s now, you know, so this was acceptable and totally the norm, you know, back in the day. But, you know, I kind of say that to frame it because I come mm-hmm. back to that very often to think about how incredible it is to come from that lineage and to, you know, have a book and to be a writer. You know, it's pretty remarkable and incredible to lead an organization, to have had a career in corporate America, you know, where I left as the CEO of a company with 2,400 employees. You know, like that is not something that I take for granted on a daily basis mm-hmm. at all. And you know, my big kind of like spiritual epiphany, you know, I would say it didn't happen in one sort of moment. It really was like this delamination or almost like an excavation, if you will, whichever way you choose mm-hmm. to look at it, that just happened layer over layer over layer. And, you know, I would say the onset, the first kind of, you know, seed that was planted with me was really being a graduate student in New York City. I was at Columbia University. I wound up getting an internship with the World Health Organization in Geneva. And when I got to Geneva, again, as an Orthodox Jew, I met so many people from religions I never heard of, countries I've literally never encountered anybody from. And I really was just enthralled and taking it all in. And so that when I got back from my internship back to school, I decided that I really wanted to learn more about, you know, Eastern wisdom and philosophy, because I really had never met a Buddhist in my life until that day, you know, that time period in Geneva. And so I wound up taking a class, and that class really led me to this kind of journey to start to meditate and expand my understanding of contemplative practice, which for me as an Orthodox Jew was very rote. It was very like prescribed. It was like, this is what you do. This is what you say. This is how many times a day you say it. That really led me down this path of like understanding that there, you know, is an ability. We have this ability to hold multiple truths in duality, which was very mind blowing to me, because I lived in a very black and white universe for a very long period of time, or at least was raised in one. And the other part of it was that it really seeded me with a practice that, even though I wasn't super adherent to it, you know, in the years after I learned how to meditate, it was something that I later returned to when I had a health scare. So, you know, when I was 27, I was going through a divorce, which even if you go through the simplest of divorces or the most amicable, it's still incredibly painful, and it can still be, you know, very traumatic in many ways. I had a toddler son. My son now, who's 20, was a toddler back then. And I was living in the same house as my then husband, now ex-husband, living together but apart, which is always a very toxic setting to be in. Mm-hmm. You're kind of in a standoff for four walls. And I woke up, you know, one morning and I couldn't see. I was totally blind. And it was probably one of the scariest moments of my life, because I didn't know at that moment, like, what I had, you know, if I would ever get my vision back. And you know, it's really crazy to think that, like, in just one moment, your life could really, you know, change that way. And yet it does for so many people. We're not guaranteed mm-hmm. tomorrow, you know? And so, in that moment, you know, that led me on a completely different journey, not just to, of course, you know, figure out what disease I had, which I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition called uveitis, which is a leading cause in blindness in people under 40. And at that time, I was told that I would probably be blind by the time I was 40. You know, those terms, the hourglass. upside down. Yep. And you kind of like start realizing, oh, at best, I have 13 more years to go put myself in the line of beauty, see all the things I want to see, get my bucket list done. You kind of like start to really realize that there's no time to waste and there's no moments to take for granted. And so that really created a big shift in my life. It lit a fire under my butt, so to speak. And I really started to value my health in a very different way and recognize that especially with an autoimmune condition, which is prone to flaring up when you're under a lot of stress and duress, that, returning to the cushion, returning to meditation, changing my diet completely, changing my life, was a big shift that needed to occur if I was going to have a fighting chance to keep my vision and also to, just remain completely present for my son as much as I could as a single mom.
Wow. And so in listening to your story here, it's almost like the possibility of losing your vision gave you more vision than you ever had. In a metaphorical sense,
totally.
The vision to, go forward and accomplish more and do things. And it focalized your spirit in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I always say that there's a difference between eyesight and vision. They're like two very different things, right? More mindset.
Yeah, you began to have vision instead of just seeing.
Exactly. You're so right.
And so where are you at now with your eyesight, and how long ago was that?
So I'm 44 now. I'm turning 45 in 2 months. I lost the vision in my left eye about, maybe it was 3 years ago. And I still have vision in my right eye. I wear corrective lenses and, it's interesting because you think you're like prepared for something and then it happens. So in many ways I was very prepared for vision loss in my left eye, but it takes a while for your physiological perceptions to catch up with your brain. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like just messes with your head a lot because it takes a while for your right eye to like overcompensate for the loss of your left eye. And so even just getting your balance back, I love board sports. So I love skateboarding and surfing and snowboarding and doing all that stuff. And it's like getting back on a board after that happened was challenging. It was frustrating because I had to kind of reorient myself, even just driving a car. Imagine if you can't see the
perception.
Depth perception, can't see the mirror on the left side, which is a problem if you want to like change lanes. You kind of like have to refigure out how to do just basic things that are so rote and inherent in the way that you operate.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that very personal, aspect about your health and your being and your journey. It really means a lot to help me understand you better. And I do think, like you shared, it really set you on a course to achieve a lot. And I think you are, and you're helping a lot of people. And it's interesting these things happen in our lives and why they happen. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm a very spiritual person. I believe in an intelligent universe. I believe in a loving creator. I'm not religious in the sense that I don't really care what you call the creator and the dogma and the names and the evolutionary religions of today. To me, it's about the spiritual values, and it's about the recognition of the created universe and us being created beings. And the meditation mindset that you practice, I think, is really important in this world of fast-paced society, and people have such a disconnect. I need to meditate more. I need to slow down. And the culture today with social media and technology and the drive, it's just so instant, fast, fast, fast.
Yeah.
It's creating ADD in kids. It's creating a attention deficit disorder. In adults, our attention span is just out the window because we're watching, 30-second videos, one-minute videos, 30-second reels on TikTok, blah, blah, blah. And so our minds are being conditioned to have no attention span and to have instant gratification and the dopamine. And all of these things lead to a larger conversation and a context around people being dissatisfied with their life.
Yeah.
Because in true life, you don't have instant gratification. Nothing takes 30 seconds, to actually achieve something good or to help somebody. And, it takes work, it takes planning, it takes vision, and it takes the long, really an understanding of the long game and the vision. And so stepping away from Sometimes the subconscious conditioning, the non-planned conditioning that we get growing up in this country, and obviously at our age, it's not as prevalent as even the young youth today. Kids in their teens and young early teens, man, I don't even know how they're going to, you know, it's a whole different world. But even me as a millennial, it's still an issue. Like, I still was raised with a digital revolution. You know, I had the first BlackBerry, the first smartphone that came out, you know, and was super into it. And, you know, these things are cool.
I love my BlackBerry.
Oh, I was obsessed. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. But, you know, it's like we can use that social media. We can use that digital presence for the good, or we can use it for selfishness, you know?
Yeah.
One thing that you shared, you know, I watched one of your videos yesterday, and you were talking about some Buddhist philosophy, and you said a quote that was a Buddhist, basically a Buddhist proverb, and it was something like, tend to the area of the garden that you can reach.
Yeah.
And that really kind of stood out to me, because so many people who have kind of that awakening want to help the world, it can be very overwhelming. How do I help, you know, this situation over here? How do I help the kid in Ukraine? Of course you are, but over time you can develop ways to do that. But the first thing is just tending to the area of the garden that you can reach, you know, really weeding the weeds out and watering the plants around you and starting there and working your way out.
Correct.
I think that kind of leads into a lot of your work with people understanding self-care. And the book you wrote, which is called Sit Down to Rise Up, which I think is a really great concept. The title alone kind of gets my mind thinking about things that sometimes to really rise and come into our true selves and our God-given personalities and ability to serve others, we do have to sit down and take a step back, work on ourselves, heal ourselves, and be ready to serve in a higher way in that capacity. And I also really like, and in another video I saw, I was stalking you a little bit, you know, doing my job. Another video, you talked about the ripple effect, and you talked about the circle of influence and the circle of concern. And that really stood out to me. But go ahead and, maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on your idea of the circle of influence and circle of concern and how to help people in that way.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. Yeah. I mean, tend to the area of the garden that you could reach is definitely a proverb that I use quite often. And, you know, the concept is really connected to and related to another mantra that I think have, especially in the last several years since founding Pandemic of Love, have just kind of hold steadfast onto is enough is a feast. And, you know, when we think about what is enough, you know, what do we really need to survive, and do the people around us within our circles of influence, in our garden, in the area of the garden that we could reach, is everyone okay? Does everybody have enough? Right. And I think that, you know, it's easy to yell at people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but if people don't have boots, then they don't have enough. They can't pull themselves up by their bootstraps, right? So it's our responsibility. I feel that it's our moral obligation, actually. I feel like it's an inherent obligation as human beings for us to make sure that everybody's got enough, that everybody has their basic needs met, has equity, is on a level playing field. And from that perspective, when you're not focused on a day-to-day basis on surviving, then you could focus on thriving. Right?
Yeah.
You could focus on really, you know, creating these beautiful circles of mutuality where this giving is reciprocal and it's reciprocated. And you can feel like, you know, that you live in an existence, in a community, that every single person that is part of that community has something to offer, regardless of how or not. And every person has something that they need also, regardless of how rich they are. So the concept of circle of influence really came from, you know, it was kind of born in the idea that, you know, being in the corporate world for two decades and running companies, you know, we look at P&Ls and we talk a lot about ROIs, about, you know, return on investments, and, you know, what's the ROI on that? You know, should we be investing in it? And I just kind of wanted to reframe the concept of ROI and to, you know, think about it as, what if it wasn't return on investment? What if it was just ripples of influence? What if we really started to measure our life based on the ripples of influence that we are responsible for. So if you think about it, proverbially, each one of us is like a pebble. And every day when we wake up, we can thrust ourselves into the pond of our community, the pond, you know, that we can reach, a pond or a garden, however you want to look at it. And what ultimately happens is that, you know, those ripples start to, you know, just move outward and expand, like the universe is ever expanding. And some of them you could see, some of them are so far reaching, you won't be able to see. But ultimately, when you keep showing up in such an incremental and consistent way on a daily basis, the ripples eventually start to join each other. And those ripples can create waves. They can create a tsunami of change if enough people are doing this on a daily basis, you know, within our communities. And so I wanted to like encourage people, especially with this book, to, you know, to recognize that, first of all, there is no such thing as like, and you hear this all the time, and it could sound cliche when you say like, there's no small act of kindness, but that's the truth. And I see this on a daily basis because I interact with so many people on a daily basis. And so I know inherently, I know that it's true that there is no small act of kindness. And when you show up on a daily basis for yourself, for others, every day, day in and day out, that the ripple effect that you generate is enormous and the impact becomes bigger and bigger and bigger because it generates momentum.
Beautiful. Totally agree. Yeah. You touched on a lot there and you talked about thriving versus just surviving. And I think that's a huge part of really the majority of the entire population of the planet. I've often said on my podcast, really, we're just in a modern day of survival mode. You know, it's the survival of the fittest, you know. Mm. We're actually just modern hunter-gatherers. We're just hunting and we're gathering more money to pay for the food, pay for the roof, pay for the bills and live that standard. But we're just hunter-gatherers, you know, just in a different form, in a sophisticated form. And how to live a life where you do have time and the ability to thrive. And it is very difficult for someone to work on themselves. To work on their spiritual ascension, their emotional healing, and all of that when there is no time in the psyche because you're literally just trying to survive and pay your bills and go to work and take care of your kids and make that car payment, make that house payment, you know, pay off your debt. You don't have time to think about meditating and how to cleanse yourself and your soul and be a better person and serve others. It's just survival mode. And that's a sad thing that people are stuck in that. Mm. And it kind of leads me to want to talk about self-care and this concept that I've gotten a little irritated with because it's been taken the wrong way of self-love. Yes. You know, I'm like self-love because it's like, oh, we need less selfishness and more selflessness, but self-love. And it's often misunderstood and can be used in the wrong way. And I frankly get tired of seeing someone with the Instagram post of them on the beach with the margarita and putting just self-love and just justifying it with self-love. Not that you don't need to have a rest and have that break and have that time, but it's gotten kind of cliche a little bit and being used in the wrong way. What I really appreciate about you and your concept of self-care is you bring in the communal pursuit and community. And to paraphrase some things that I've read in your book and some videos, you basically say in order to really have good self-care, you have to have community around you and you have to be involved in community. Self-care is being in community and working with others and serving others. And I really appreciate that take because it can become very self-centric, the idea of self-love and self-care, and you become self-absorbed. I've been guilty of it. I've been really gone deep within trying to heal and change certain aspects of myself that need to change. And in that, I've become quite self-absorbed and selfish and cut off my ability to see the needs of others around me. When that happens to millions and millions of people, we have a problem on our hands. And so I like your concept of that self-love. And just real quick, I don't know if you looked at all into my lifestyle, but I'm very blessed to live in an actual community. So I literally have community living. I live on 220 acres with 100 other people from all over the world. And we share, we grow food together, we create together. This community was founded by my parents 35 years ago. called, and it's called, yeah, Avalon Organic Gardens and Eco Village. And it's in beautiful southern Arizona in the Santa Cruz River Valley. And we have people from all over the world learning together, growing together, and serving together. It's a beautiful concept. It's a spiritual community. And the reason why we can stay together is because of the spiritual foundation. You have to have a unified collective consciousness. You have to have spiritual unity to actually get along and to get through and to get, you know, getting along with people is more difficult than people may understand. And it's the spiritual values, and you'll understand this, it's the spiritual values that enable you to do that, to get past these differences, to get past misunderstandings, and to transcend to a higher way. But in what I'm trying to make the link here is that I feel blessed in my life that I am able to have that self-care, that self-love, that true enlightened self-awareness because of the lifestyle that I live. So I am able to thrive and not just survive because of community living.
Yeah.
So it is actually linked. Like my ability to care for myself is linked by the amount of people that care for me.
Definitely. Well, you know, first of all, it's amazing. In Israel, we call that a kibbutz. So
yeah. And many people have said like, oh, you're in a kibbutz. I'm like, pretty much.
Yeah. That's awesome. Super cool. Definitely a utopian society. And idea, because it's a place where mutual aid is completely enacted all the time. And there is that safety net that we so desperately need in other areas of this country. But what I will say is that, you know, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that the term, first of all, self-care should really be retired, like, because I think people in the Western culture think that they automatically think self and they think, you know, individual, because we're so conditioned by the industrial wellness complex to think that self means individual. Whereas really, you know, as spiritual beings, right, you and I could probably agree on the concept that self doesn't end where this like meat suit that we're walking around in, you know, actually ends. It's not just the I that is sitting here talking to you. The self extends way beyond this, you know, it extends to every interaction that I have. It extends to everything that happened in the past, everything that will happen in the future, you know, not just what's happening right now in the present. Like somebody will listen to this podcast in a year from now and, you know, we will have impacted their life. And so it lends itself to this understanding, this concept of the self being larger than just one individual, that we are not just interconnected human beings, but as Dr. Dan Siegel says, we're intraconnected human beings, which means that when we think about ourselves as interconnected human beings, we are separate entities that are connected. But when we think about it as intraconnected, it means that we really are just part of one larger organism. And if we can understand that, again, if part of that organism is not functioning properly or correctly, just like it does in other areas of nature. So if you look at a coral reef system, if the coral is dying, the rest of the ecosystem is not doing well. You know, if it's a rainforest and so on. And so for some reason, us humans, I don't know where we got away from this. I'm sure we could pinpoint this, but I do think it has a lot to do with capitalism. I think that, you know, that the fact is that, you know, we got away from this concept that we are like part of this ecosystem and that we need to make sure that everybody in that ecosystem therefore has enough and has access to surviving and then thriving. I think that really, you know, going back to just the premise of the book, I think, you know, I try to kind of create that connection between the fact that there's, yes, inner work is important, but the inner work is only, you know, important if you can connect it then to the outer world and how you're showing up in the outer world, and that the best version of the world has to start with the best version of us. So it's like this constant reflecting back and this beautiful symbiotic relationship between us constantly improving ourselves so that we can show up more fully, more wholly, be more present, and do more for the world that we're living in.
Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, what you're sharing really, I did some research beforehand, and I found a quote based upon some of your writings and videos that I really think you'd appreciate and basically sums up kind of what you were just saying. I read a book called The Urantia Book. Have you ever heard of it?
Mm-mm.
It's quite a book. It's over 2,000 pages long. It's an epical revelation that was brought through to the planet in the early 1900s, kind of the mystery of who wrote it and who the author is and how it came about. Definitely encourage you to check it out. It's not a book you can, you know, you have to read from front to back. You can kind of skim through it. There's different parts that are more easy to understand than others. But anyways, the last part of the book is about the life and teachings of Jesus. And the Jesus in the Urantia book is a lot bigger than the Jesus of our understanding in the evolutionary religions of today. It's a cosmic Christ who's much more vast and integrated into a very intelligent, designed universe. But one of the quotes is, and I'll read it for you here. Spiritual living mightily increases true self-respect, but self-respect is not self-admiration. Self-respect is always coordinate with the love and service of one's fellows.
Mm-hmm.
It is not possible to respect yourself more than you love your neighbor. The one is the measure of the capacity for the other. And so that like just hits the nail on the head for me.
I think so. I think it totally does. I mean, what can you possibly add to that? And that's really the truth. That is the honest truth, that I think that when we recognize that our time here on this earth, our very limited time here on this earth as this representation of ourselves, right, is so shallow. If we really truly believe that it's only to be in pursuit of acquiring things or to be in competition with somebody else, or to, just by whatever measure society has these days, you know, because it changes, every few generations, but to demonstrate to people that we are the fittest, you know, by that definition makes absolutely no sense. And I think that, we really have to start looking to nature and emulating just the way that that nature cooperates and exists to thrive and move beyond survival, because we've been in this mindset. And I really do, you know, I talk about the concept of mutual aid in the book, and you know, mutual aid has been around for thousands of years, and it was around prior to the term mutual aid even really, being given to it by Kropotkin, who was a Russian anarchist. Basically, he was like a social anarchist. You know, he was a social biologist, and really was so frustrated with the fact that people were hijacking Charles Darwin's work, and social psychologists and biologists and economists, and saying, you know, they the sliver, like if you ask anybody today, especially in Western countries, like, you know, Charles Darwin, like, what comes to your mind? Survival of the fittest. That's like the first thing that they will tell you. And yet that is such a small sliver of what Charles Darwin's work was about, because really, he really also talked about the cooperation of our, you know, ecosystems and what happens when those, you know, ecosystems move beyond just surviving and they could thrive. And I think like all that is lost. And so we've sort of taken this one concept, we've hijacked it to appropriate it for the excuse for the way that capitalism is really, being taken on today. And it's just a crying shame. It really is. And I try to kind of like get people to understand that, you know, we kind of got to go back to primary resources at this point, and to, which I know is like a really hard thing to do when you have Wikipedia and you live in this, like you said, you know, going back to your earlier comment, like, you know, I talked to my son about who's writing like research papers in college right now. And I'm like, I feel like a dinosaur because I'm talking to him about the card catalog and we had the Dewey Decimal System and we had to microfiche for like things. And, you know, just like all of these, this concept of like what it actually took to do research versus like just Googling something and actually having like a bunch of resources that of which many of them are not even acceptable and don't pass that litmus test of like what, you know, what is true, what is a primary source. And so I think we've got to go back to primary sources. And I think one of the biggest primary sources we have to go back to, which the COVID pandemic has proven, is going back to nature and looking at nature.
Yeah. And nature is inherently divine, you know, it's evolved and it's created, and it brings back that sense of awe and that sense of connection and reality and connectedness. You know, so there's kind of a funny dichotomy about our culture in the world today, because we're more connected digitally than we've ever been. Like you said, we can pull up our phone, connect to anybody in the world, connect to information instantly, connect to whatever you want. And in that, we've become the most disconnected we've ever been.
Yep.
We need to get our feet on the earth, and we're disconnected from humanity, from our, you know, intuition, from that tribal spirit of connection. You know, human beings lived in tribes for a millennium, and now we're isolated and disconnected from that. And the tribal living, to me, is like the key to success. And I'm not literally saying necessarily, I use the term tribal living, but modern day tribal living, sense of community, sharing all things in common. There's actually very few examples on the planet of true community living. You know, I mean, there are the kibbutzes, and so you're familiar with that. And there's a sense of that in those kibbutzes and different things. But community living in the sense that you're sharing all things in common, you're pooling together. You know, in our community, we do pool together all of our resources. And it's a lot to explain how that all works, you know, over the podcast, but it does work. And it's hard for people to fathom that in a world where you're raised to have your own bank account, make your money, do this, isolist, ultra individualism, you know, Ayn Rand, you know, they're all into that. And to see a prototype society that can actually run on fairness, equality, and mutual aid, the true concept of mutually aiding each other. You know, my success is your success. I can't actually succeed in life if others around me aren't succeeding in life.
Right.
That's actually a spiritual absolute. That's a principle that a lot of people don't understand. You've tapped into that through your life experiences, realizing that your success for your soul and spirit is actually the success of others. When I say success, I don't mean rising to the top and the CEO and the four-car garage and meeting the American dream. I mean the success of spirit, the success of accomplishment. This person, like you said, who's up in the mountains, who doesn't even have running water, success to them would just be getting a well in, you know?
Yeah.
Success for them would just be getting their kids some clean water at the end of the day. So the spectrum of humanity and how we value things and what we're trying to achieve is really, you know, off in different parts of the world right now. I want to circle back a little bit to what I'm just going to, you know, call your awakening experience.
Sure.
Because part of my podcast is the pursuit to self-mastery and helping people to kind of realize the spiritual journey, realize to master self, realize to, you have to sometimes leave Egypt to come into the promised land, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you left Egypt, you know, and I've had a lot of people on my show, so to speak, who've left Egypt. And in leaving that corporate world, I'm sure that there were times where it was very difficult because you probably had to disassociate yourself with friends, maybe even family, people who didn't understand your choices, who judged you. And probably a majority might have celebrated, too, your choices. But in encouraging people, and if you had some words of advice to, like, say someone pulls up this podcast right now, they're working that corporate job. They're unhappy. They might be making six figures a year, but their life is empty. They go back to their apartment in Manhattan. They have no community. They're not serving people. And they're afraid maybe to break the cycle that they live in. They're afraid to leave that comfort zone. What would be your words of advice to break free from that and to become a change agent, become a servant? You know, in our community, we call them change agents, people who can serve and create change.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an excellent question. And I think that there's a few, you know, a few different things that I could think of. The first is that, you know, making a decision, like people think that I like just woke up one morning and I was like, well, I'm quitting my job. Yeah. And like, no, I had a fiduciary responsibility and a contract. I was running a company. But I started to like really become, and the meditation really does help with this. When you get silent, things get very loud. Your body starts to tell you things. You start to like really have this space to really perceive like where are you holding tightness and like where's your anxiety coming from, and all these other sorts of like thoughts that you normally just kind of push away into the recesses of your mind and maybe don't get back to because you're so busy, and we fill up our life with this like busyness culture. And so, yeah, you know, in kind of getting quiet and recognizing, you know, that I was unhappy, I started to think about, you know, what life would look like if I, you know, was going to pursue happiness or fulfillment. You know, what would that look like? And the reality is that I didn't have an answer. I didn't have like, I'm leaving this for this, which was also very scary, right? I didn't have like a game plan. I wasn't like jumping into something else. I actually have always in my entire life been the type of person that always had a plan B, plan D. And for once in my life, I was like, you know, I need to just have the space to create and process and try and fail and be flexible. And so I left the corporate, I made the decision to leave the corporate world, and I didn't actually do it for like a year until, you know, from around a year from the date that I actually decided to do it. And I was talking to a friend, or complaining to a friend, I should say, about how miserable I was at work. And she said to me, she gave me a pen and a paper, and she said, here, write your resignation letter. And I was like, what? I can't write, like, I'm not going to resign now. I have too many obligations. And she said, no, you can post date it for a date, any date. Hmm. And so I did. I post dated it for about a year later. And I wound up resigning actually 2 weeks before that letter was, wow, was dated, which is, I think, so incredible, because I think like once you put something in writing it and you tell somebody, it sort of becomes realer. It becomes, yeah, tangible. And there's this like level and measure of like accountability, and also not without fear, of course, you know, but you also feel like, okay, I guess I'm doing this. So you really start to like take the steps to work towards that. So it took me about a year to, you know, refigure out my finances and modify my life and downgrade like a lot of things, you know, that I realized like, okay, I don't need this fancy car. Like I can just, you know, or if I'm not working, like maybe my husband and I can get by on one car. You know, you start to kind of reevaluate things so that financially you could continue to, you know, to survive as you're figuring things out. But what I will say is that, you know, I don't think that I could have even made that decision to do any of that or written that letter if I didn't know that I had the safety net of my community. If I didn't know that I had a number of people that were in my court and that would be cheering me on, that would be my sounding board, that would help me sort of navigate the waters as mentors, as allies, as peers. You know, everybody kind of has a different role in your life. But I think that if you try to go at it alone, then, you know, it's going to be much harder to succeed. And also, what is success? Like we said, if you're not sharing it with other people, you know? And so I would say, you know, make it tangible, figure out like, you know, a timeline. I don't care if you don't have all the answers and you don't know what you're doing, but make it tangible. The second thing is get yourself a community of care that is like a real formalized community of care. Identify the people that you want to rally around you so that you can not feel alone, especially in your scariest moment. You know, and there's a great quote by Joseph Campbell, which is, you know, life, it's like jumping out of an airplane, but realizing, or without a parachute, but then eventually realizing that there's no ground, that you're not going to make impact. So you can finally like enjoy the free fall. And that's like a paraphrase. But really, that's what it was like for me. When I left the corporate world, I left behind my identity. You know, for so long, the first question, as you know, people ask you when you go into like any place, they say, what's your name and what do you do? They want to know what you do for a living, because that is how you are defined in our Western culture, right? They don't ask you like, what are your passions and, you know, what's your favorite, you know, song or whatever. And so it was so interesting afterwards for me to go to like different types of settings where people were all gainfully employed and people would say, what do you do? And I was like scrambling at first, you know, trying to like reaching for clouds to like figure out what to respond, because my identity was so closely aligned to like that part of my life. And, you know, now I just say, you know, I'm a good Samaritan. Like that's my, people are like, what does that mean? And then we get into a whole conversation about what that means. But it's really interesting, you know, to kind of like see where, check your ego. That's like the third thing, is really check your ego and like how closely defined is your perception of yourself, and how closely aligned is it to like what it is that you do, you know? And how do you kind of, how do you reroute that? How do you reappropriate that to be more aligned with just like your vision and your mission and your values as a human being versus that of a mission and values of a company or a corporation?
Yeah. Very cool. Have you heard of a book called The Diamond Cutter?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really profound book that I've been studying for six years now or so. And, you know, it's about this man, and you mentioned your Buddhism earlier, and you know, he went into Tibet and he was in a monastery. He was the first Westerner white guy to be in a monastery for 20 years straight. And after he completed 20 years, his Buddhist master said, now your assignment is to go back into America and work in the corporate world and apply these Buddhist principles and philosophies into a business, into the corporate structure of an American business. And he was like, what? It's the last thing he wanted to do. He's been in a monastery for 20 years in Tibet, man. Like, so he went back, and he did. He actually started a diamond company and, you know, selling diamonds, sourcing diamonds, selling them, which is interesting. But he applied all of this Buddhist philosophy and principles into the way he launched his business, how he ran his business, into the decisions he made. And it was very fascinating, the mindset and the mindfulness that he had around every single decision, and in turn, how that resulted in being a very, very successful business. Yeah. But really, what's interesting is his end goal wasn't greed. It wasn't to, oh, make $1 million, multi-million-dollar transnational diamond business, which he did, and make all this money. He just said, let me try and succeed by using spiritual principles rather than the selfish, greedy, capitalist principles. And he's gone on to then use, you know, the wealth to start training schools and to help people. And, you know, he wrote this book, and he has these ways to, you know, sharpen our minds, control our thoughts. And the biggest thing that stood out to me in that book is the Buddhist principle that compassion is the gateway to all other spiritual values. And I've been contemplating that for several years, because sometimes we can think it's another, you know, like the gate, it's love or this, but compassion to me, when I'm feeling disconnected, I try and tap into empathy and compassion, because then compassion allows me to get out of myself. And it is true that it is the gateway to pretty much God and spirituality and the true essence of divinity. Because when you start having compassion for other people, for other circumstances, you're outside of yourself, and you're able to serve. And so I'm trying to live a compassionate life. My spiritual elders that I go to for help, my mentors that I go to for guidance, you know, if I sit down and say, how do I become a more compassionate person? That's helpful information. That's spiritual food that I'm receiving from my spiritual body to strengthen myself and to live. But those questions aren't being asked by the millions of people in the world. They're not sitting down saying, how do I become more compassionate? Some are asking that in their meditations. I think you essentially asked that question, maybe not those exact words, on your journey, and your compassion allowed you to start the pandemic of love, which I love, by the way, the name, because here you are, March 2020, the whole world shutting down, and it's the pandemic of fear, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the fear, things are shutting down. I mean, I remember in 2020 when it first started happening, I was away from my home at the time and traveling, and my first thought was, I got to get back to my home, back to my family. They're going to shut down the highways. You know, shit's going down. They're going to cut off the food supply, this and that, and your mind goes there, you know? And then there was a lot of fear-based rhetoric in the media. And so you switched it and reversed it out of the desire to help others, the pandemic of love. And, you know, you helped people. And I think I read something like now to date, there was, what is it, $290 million have been, is that the figure? Is that?
No, it's, well, it's almost 2.4 million people have been matched directly, and almost $60 million has been transacted directly.
Yeah. And that's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a lot of money helping people. And I think we can forget that if there's a single mom in an apartment who can't pay her rent, that $800 a month, and that gets paid, that's life-changing for her. She's literally not in the streets. She was going to be in the streets.
No,
she's not.
That's right.
And those of us who are,
those
of us who are sitting back, you know, not worrying about that, we don't.
Yeah.
It's the compassion that allows us to feel that, you know, for her and help her.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, the model of pandemic of love is really interesting in that, you know, a lot of times, even with mutual aid, like it's, you basically, you know, may be able to like send money into a Venmo account and then the mutual aid community sends it out to somebody else. And with Pandemic of Love, what we've done is, you know, the organization has sort of stepped out of the way. We just make connections. We're matchmakers.
Yeah.
And so we vet the person in need. We vet the donor because we have a responsibility there, a fiduciary responsibility. And so, and after we do that, we connect them and we step out of the way. And so, yes, the bill gets paid. But more than that happens. What happens is that in order for the transaction to occur, the donor has to pick up the phone and have a conversation with the person in need. And can you imagine, if you're a single mom, you're about to get evicted, you've had many sleepless nights, you don't know where this money is going to come from, and suddenly somebody calls you and says, you know, hi, Jane, you know, I heard that you were having some trouble and I'd like to help you pay your rent. Or how can I help you? What do you need? Many times, especially in this country and especially in the most impoverished and, you know, underserved areas, people don't hear those types of questions and statements, you know, and that really like is the biggest gift for people. Not that paying that bill is not a big gift, but the fact that somebody made them feel seen and heard in a time of disconnection, a time, like you said, where we're not, you know, just there's so much inhumanity that's going on and things are so impersonal, to feel seen and heard, especially by somebody who is a quote unquote, a perfect stranger. And the gift for the other person, the donor on the other side, is that they get to walk a mile in somebody's shoes and put on different lenses, right? We all live in our own conditioning. And it's so hard for so many of us, which is why this country is so polarized at this point, this world in a way, you know, is like, this is the lens that we see the world out of. And if we're not willing to take that pair of glasses off and put on another pair of glasses and see the world through somebody else's eyes, then we really miss this incredible opportunity to connect with people on a completely different level. And so the gift has been that we've been able to connect people across all perceived divides, right? Whether they're generational or race or religion or political, whatever perceived divide, people who thought, I can't be friends with this type of a person, you know, with the stories that we tell ourselves about certain types of people. And yet, when you meet somebody and you can connect and have proximity on that level, then your mind suddenly changes because you realize that we are all from the same human family, that we all bleed the same, that we all are capable of connecting heart center to heart center. And that's a beautiful thing to witness that shift in so many people. And as I said, we've connected over 2 million people at this point. And so we have tens of thousands of stories that we know of, at least, that people have sent in to share their experiences that they had with the person that we were connecting them to transact with, which is, I think, one of the biggest gifts.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's really beautiful what you've done with Pandemic of Love. And our listeners here should definitely go check that out and Google it, go to the website, find out how you can help and get involved, because it's pretty cool to directly help people, cut out the middleman, so to speak, and to bless people's lives. You know,
yeah.
It is a good reminder that the simplest things, you know, even $50 might change someone's course of their life that day when they're that down on their luck. Mm. You know, it doesn't take much, and it's good for us, all humanity, to remember that the small things do matter and count. You know, we don't have to feed an entire third world country with 3 million people. You know, we can help someone right down the street if we have to.
Yeah.
And if we can feed an entire country, great, we should. There are some people who have the money or who are actually capable of that. But again, it kind of leads back to tend to the area of your garden you can reach.
Yeah.
And if we all did that, you know, the world would be a better place very quickly. And
yeah.
I definitely thank you for your part in being a change agent on this planet and helping others, and your dedication. I'm definitely inspired. I think our listeners are inspired too by what you're doing. And, you know, I really thank you for coming on the show, taking the time. And I encourage you to check out Avalon Organic Gardens and Eco Village, which is my home and community.
Yeah.
And it's something I've dedicated my life to building. I think you're an individual who would really appreciate it and understand what we're trying to achieve here and help the world, ourselves, in the way that we can, and build a prototype society based on all the things we've actually talked about. And
yeah.
So, yeah, you're one of the good seeds, and I bless you on your journey and all that you're doing, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Have a really beautiful and blessed day.
You too.
Check out my website at getrealordietrying.com. Leave me a voicemail on anchor.fm/getrealordietrying. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or any of the platforms you listen on. Be sure to follow me on social media and share this podcast with your friends. Word of mouth is a great way to share the vibe. Get Real or Die Trying with Amadon Delerba is a production of Global Change Media. And remember, pain is temporary, victory is eternal.